yeah. Taking you back musically to the summer of 1986. A memorable baseball season and an unforgettable ending to it for the Boston Red Sox in the World Series against the New York Mets that year. All of it chronicled in a wonderful new book by author Eric Sherman. He's the author of several books, including Kings of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with the 86 Mets, so the co-author of After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets with friend of our show, Art Shamsky. The new one, Two Sides of Glory, the 1986 Boston Red Sox. In their own words, we are pleased to be joined by Eric Sherman. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me this afternoon.
I was looking back at our archives. It was just about 2 years ago that we had your co-author, Art Shamsky, on to talk about After the Miracle, and what a wonderful book that was.
Oh, thank you very much. In fact, there was just a write-up today about it a couple of years after the book came out in ESPN.com. They wrote a piece on the 69 Mets, which talked at length about the book that we worked on together and our trip out to Calistoga, California, with some of the other 69 Mets to visit Tom Seaver. So, it was a pleasure to work on that project with Art.
Well, and that reunion comes back to us here in Two Sides of Glory as well. What it must have been like to be there with that brotherhood of teammates getting together at Tom Seaver's place.
Well, it really was. You know, we took Jerry Kuzman, Rocky Swoboda, and Buddy Harrelson along with us, and it was the last time those brothers of the 69 New York Mets got together, because shortly thereafter, Tom Seaver's health began to fail, and Buddy Harrelson at that time was in the beginnings of Alzheimer's, and now that's really progressed as well. So it was really the last opportunity to get that very special core group of 69 Mets together, and I'm so glad that we did. We had such a wonderful time at Tom's, and it was bittersweet. None of them wanted to leave after our lunch that day, and but the memory will last forever, and I was so glad that I was able to write about it in our book, After the Miracle. I mean, it was an honor to be there with them.
Well, and you've done that same thing with the story of the 86 season in the World Series, and you've really captured much more than a baseball story. It's really a story about friendship and teamwork and forgiveness and humanity and kindness and some tremendous interviews, really getting the words of so many guys who were a part of that team. How were you able to get so many different people to participate in this?
With the 86 Red Sox,
yeah.
Correct?
Yes.
Yes. I think it helped a lot that I knew Marty Barrett. We had actually thought about writing a book together on the 86 Red Sox all the way back in 1993. We had a book proposal, but the publishing industry deemed it just too soon to write about 86, that it was still too fresh, even though it was 7 years. You know, the way the World Series had ended, Red Sox fans were still hurting from it. But, you know, through Marty, I got to know some of the other guys, and Pam Ken, who's the alumni director with the Red Sox, was very helpful. Tim Neverett, who is now a Dodgers broadcaster. He was a Red Sox broadcaster when I started the project, and he helped me, as did Joe Castiglione, the Red Sox Hall of Fame broadcaster. He was a huge help as well. So, you know, when you're trying to put together a book like this, where you want to have these intimate conversations in person, wherever these ball players live or work, you need help from several different sources. And just like with my 86 Mets book, Kings of Queens, where I did basically the same thing, you know, you need help, and wherever the help may come, that's where you go.
One of the things that I found so interesting was you were able to get people who had been very reluctant to talk not only to agree to talk, but to actually talk. I thought that the interviews with Bruce Hurst and Calvin Schiraldi were incredibly moving. I'm a diehard Yankees fan. I always root for the American League. I remember all my friends' heartbreak from that time. How did you manage to get them to all talk without throwing anybody under the bus, without any, there was no acrimony in this book? I thought that was phenomenally well done.
Well, thank you. So you just named the two guys that were the biggest challenge to get, and they were actually my last two interviews of the book. So with Bruce Hurst, he hadn't talked about 86 in 4 years. And he had pretty much told himself, you know, this is it. It's just too painful. I've talked about it again and again in the past. I don't want to relive it. And one of his teammates, who I interviewed, I said, yeah, you know, he asked me, are you having trouble getting to anybody? And I said, yeah, Bruce Hurst doesn't want to talk. And he said, you're kidding. Bruce is great. You know, so he gave me his phone number and I gave it a shot. And Bruce actually thought I was Pam Ken, who, you know, the alumni director of the Red Sox, who is so she's so popular with the Red Sox alumni. You know, the players just love her. So he picks up the phone and he's like, hey, how's it going? And so I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe he was tipped off I was going to call and he's willing to talk now. And so he thought I was Pam, and he said, look, you know, with all due respect, I just can't, you know, talk about it anymore. So I said to him, you know, I've got everybody else. And finally he acquiesced, and he said to me, well, I don't want to be that guy. And so I said, look, when I fly out to Arizona, 45 minutes, that's all I need. And he goes to me, Eric, if you fly all the way from New York to Phoenix to come see me, I'll give you as much time as you need. So my expectations weren't that high because he wasn't really on board. It took me a half hour on the phone to convince him to talk to me. And it turned out to be arguably the most riveting interview, not just in this book, but in any book that I've written. Calvin Schiraldi was similar. Ed Hearn, the former Mets backup catcher, is a dear friend of his, and so he gave me the seal of approval. Calvin accepted to invite me into his home in Austin, Texas, and that interview went, you know, terrific as well.
We're talking with Eric Sherman about his book, Two Sides of Glory. The interviews with Bill Buckner were so poignant, more so because of his passing. I was struck among the many things you talked about with Buckner about him noticing a sign when he came back to Fenway that said, we forgive you, and how that impacted him, because he deservedly felt like there was no need. He didn't need to be forgiven because he hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, that didn't make him happy, that's for sure. I mean, he looked around the ballpark and, you know, I mean, it was 99% positive, but he sees these banners that people are holding up, you know, a couple of them, I believe, and they said, we forgive you, Buck, or something like that. And you know, Buckner's like, you forgive me. I mean, yeah. I forgive you, you know, for the negativity surrounding that error. I mean, this is a guy that had 2,715 career hits. He won a batting title. He had a higher fielding percentage than Lou Gehrig. And in 85 and 86, I mean, he put up tremendous offensive numbers for the Red Sox. And you know, first one to the ballpark because he'd have to get all bandaged up. And I mean, he was a warrior. So he certainly didn't need any forgiveness.
Of all the things you discovered, what was the most surprising to you?
I think the thing that surprised me the most about these interviews was the intelligence of Oil Cam Boyd. That really surprised me because, you know, I remember in 86 he was a loose cannon. You know, he was suspended for I think almost a month. He got snubbed from the All-Star game, and he really went on a tantrum. He shoved a photographer and was suspended. You know, he probably would have won 20 games that season. He ended up with 16, but he missed, I think, six starts. And he just seemed like a loose cannon to me. And until you meet him, and then there's really two oil can Boyds. There's, you know, the street smart guy that, you know, talks with a swagger and, you know, a little bit of jive. And then he flips a switch and he starts talking about American history with you and about the plight of, you know, the African American. And I swear, he could get up in front of a college classroom and be very much professor-like. So he's very insightful. So that surprised me the most, I think, about all the interviews that I did, aside from just a general feeling of how much these guys cared. And that came through in their emotion. Gedman, Boggs, Hurst, a couple of the others, you know, really got emotional in these interviews. And, and we're talking over three decades later. So that emotion really stuck with me.
And I really enjoyed the chapter with Rich Gedman. Back in the late 80s, I was coaching high school baseball, and I worked at a baseball camp down at Babson College that Rich Gedman ran. And I remember going to the park one night to see a game, and he was taking batting practice and going down to chat with him before the game. And he said, the great thing about being a Worcester kid, I get booed by my neighbors. and I thought, that's one of the reasons why, as he mentions, it still hurts all these years later for him, because he was that local kid who grew up watching the Sox.
Well, sure. I mean, he was one of those kids that, you know, had posters of Yastrzemski and Conigliaro and just lived and died, you know, with the Red Sox. You know, they came so close in 75. They came so close in 77 and 78 especially. And, I mean, he was the true New Englander, you know, someone that understood the history of the Red Sox and how much that region just embraced the Red Sox and all they had gone through. And here they were one strike away from ending the 68-year curse of the Bam Bambino. So Gedman, more than anyone on that Red Sox team, got it. And I think the fact that things kind of unraveled in Game 6 and with that wild pitch slash pass ball, he carries this pain today that still exists, over them not being able to get that last strike, that last out, and bring the championship home to New England. It still eats at him today.
And in a way, it seems to me that it was even harder because of the way the previous series had ended, the incredible night in California when everybody was celebrating and then they weren't celebrating. And so that it seemed like destiny was finally there in 86. 67 didn't feel that way, you know. But 86, destiny, they won when they weren't supposed to win. Then it collapsed as a team.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, no team in the history of baseball experienced the highest of highs and the lowest of lows within a two-week period in October like the 86 Red Sox. They were one strike away from elimination in Game 5 of a best-of-seven series against the Angels, and they pull off the miracle of all miracles. They win the Game 5, then they come back in Boston, win the next two. They go to the series. There's an element to all that where they were just so close. Pulling off the miracle of all miracles. And it was different than 67 or 75 in this respect. They picked up Donnie Baylor before the season started. He was really the leader and the enforcer that they needed. Then mid-season, You know, they trade Steve Lyons for Tom Seaver. Mm-hmm. You know, Seaver, of course, it was his last season, but, you know, it gave an indication to Sox Nation that, you know, this team's really going to go for it. You know, we just traded for Tom Seaver. I mean, and he's going to be our fourth or fifth starter. There was a tremendous amount of excitement over that acquisition. Standing room only, his first time that he pitched at Fenway. And then in August, they go out and get Dave Henderson and Spike Owen. And, I mean, picking up those guys, I mean, it turned out to be tremendous in October. So there was a sense that they were not going to allow themselves to falter. The front office was behind them, and there was just this will to close it out, and they did.
And I think it was appropriate that Bob Stanley and Dwight Evans also were able to put it all in perspective, because they both had to deal with some very serious health issues for their children, and that makes you put baseball in its proper place.
Well, it does. I mean, in Dwight Evans' case, I mean, he played most of his career, you know, where he would be leaving a hospital after one of his kids, one of his two boys who suffered from what's commonly known as elephant man's disease. So he'd be coming straight from the hospital, visiting his kids, you know, one of his boys, and going right to the ballpark, you know, sleepless nights. And he related to me this one story, which I just found incredible. I mean, it was right out of Pride of the Yankees when Lou Gehrig went to visit a sick boy in the hospital. His son said to him, "Hey, Dad, would you hit me a home run tonight?" And Dwight goes, "Yeah, no, okay, well, I've got to go. And his son goes, wait, Dad, would you hit me two home runs tonight?" And he goes, "Oh, okay, you know, I'll try. Well, that night he did, and I know that he did because I was 16 years old and I was going to Ted Williams baseball camp, and we had a field trip to Fenway Park that night in 1982, and Dewey hit the two home runs, and I remember him looking up at the sky after his second one. And then could you imagine, you know, decades later, I'm sitting in Fenway Park talking to Dewey about it, and he's telling me the story. And so now I know why he was looking up at the sky. You know, he was thanking God for assisting him in hitting those two home runs for his son.
That's a wonderful story, and a terrific book as well. Two Sides of Glory, the 1986 Boston Red Sox, in their own words. Eric, thank you so much. We love the book. We appreciate you making time for us this afternoon.
Oh, anytime. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Eric Sherman with us here on Sports Lit 101.